Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Bjorkman, Judge Bond, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes, Jr. presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Thursday, February 13th, 2025. We have three cases on our calendar for today, on our oral calendar, I should say. The first one is A24-1486, Delvin Cook versus Gracelyn Trimble, and I hope I'm pronouncing those names right. For this case and all the subsequent cases, the appellant will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant if you so choose. The podium can be raised or lowered. There's a button on the underneath side, and please feel free to adjust the microphone as well. This is being recorded, and an audio recording of this proceeding will be available sometime within the next day or two for any of the parties or anybody else who would like to listen to them. And then, however, no other recordings are permitted of this proceeding. And also, as a side note, I understand that we may have some special guests here. Legislative Pages, I believe.
House of Representatives High School Pages are here this morning.
Okay, wonderful. Welcome to all of you. I hope you enjoy the proceedings today. I don't know if you're going to be staying for one or both of the, just one? Okay. And after that, you're certainly welcome to leave after that. And we hope you have an enjoyable experience here. So with that, counsel for appellant, when you approach a podium, please state your name for the record and the party you are representing, and you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Chris Morris from the Bassford Remley Law Firm. It's my honor to be representing the appellants in this case, who are defendants, as well the Eklund and Blando Law Firm, and two of its lawyers who are individually named. I'd like to introduce two folks from the Eklund and Blando firm that are here in the courtroom. Ann St. Amet, she is an associate at the firm, named individually as a defendant, and also Mark Blando, who is a partner at the firm. Welcome to the pages as well. I started out my career as a Senate page many years ago, so glad to see you here. This is an appeal from Hennepin County District Court's denial of a special motion for expedited relief under the Uniform Public Expression Protection Act.
Before you get too far into your argument, I just want to make sure that we're on the same page in terms of our standard of review. I understand it's de novo, correct?
I think we all agree it's de novo review, yes. I thought that to start out, it might be helpful to try to synthesize the issues a bit by having allowing me to give you a suggestion on what I think the syllabus might include, or 4 points for the syllabus or the opinion when Your Honors do the work to write your opinion in this case. Just briefly, first point would be denial of a special motion for expedited relief under the new Public Expression Protection Act is immediately appealable in recognition of the vital importance of free speech in the litigation context. Second, a public figure's defamation claim must fail when the claim attacks opposing counsel's communications of their client's allegations and a genuine fact dispute exists regarding that claim of the client. So here, for example, because Mr. Cook could never have gotten summary judgment on the merits of the Ms. Trimble's claims in the underlying case, the gist of what we're talking about here, that she alleged she was assaulted by Mr. Cook, there can be no actual malice as required to meet the standard of the defamation claim. Third, the litigation privilege absolutely protects factual statements in attorney-prepared pleadings made in support of a client's claim or argument. Any other rule would have devastating effects on the litigation process in Minnesota. And finally, attorney representation of a client may reasonably include communications with the press, and when so, attorney immunity applies. Here, what was communicated to the press was exactly what was contained in the privileged pleadings.
The third and fourth one seem to be closely related, and you seem to be arguing for a very, very broad rule there, which I understand the courts across the country are split on that. We have not addressed that issue in Minnesota yet. We touched on it a little bit in the Mahoney case, but that seems like an awfully broad rule.
Are you referring to the press?
In terms of the judicial proceedings privilege, which you call the litigation privilege or absolute privilege, which I think the absolute privilege title might actually be a little bit of a misnomer, but that judicial proceeding privilege, it sounds like you're arguing that it should be a broad rule that covers any communications with the press.
The litigation privilege is absolute. I believe this court called it absolute in its decision issued in the related case a couple months ago.
That's because we're referring to the language that the special master used.
Right. The I do not mean to suggest that my last bullet point here was in reference to attorney immunity. Okay. So that's talking about.
Thank you for the clarification.
If an attorney is acting within the scope of their work for the client, then in communicating with the press, we're not suggesting that attorneys have immunity to say whatever they want to the press whenever, and it's always cloaked in immunity. It's not that broad of a rule. It can be something that is judged on a case-by-case basis, but here I think that it's very clear that it must apply.
Well, but I mean, isn't the argument from the other side that your clients knowingly participated in unlawful conduct in terms of the interactions with the press statements made? I mean, I know you would disagree, but isn't there an issue to be tried around those lines?
Not at all, Your Honor. This is where I'm suggesting my third bullet point. Let's look at the let's look at the actual malice element for a moment.
Which again is not so. We're stepping aside from the question of privilege, right? To the
okay.
actual
there,
merits
there are
of the
two
case.
Different concepts, right? So, but your honor asks about this was wrongful conduct.
Well, I mean, I think that is one of the provisos in the attorney immunity is that there wouldn't be immunity for an attorney who is knowingly participating in unlawful activity with the client.
There are some cases cited in the briefs where, for example, an attorney participates in some kind of fraud on the court, some kind of fraudulent scheme. Those are very unusual situations. And there are circumstances like that where attorney immunity might not apply. And maybe even litigation privilege wouldn't apply if the pleadings that you're talking about don't even relate to the matter. And that's what the Hennepin County Court decided in this case. That, for example, filing a brief in response to a motion in limine, making arguments about whether certain evidence should be admissible at trial, did not even relate to that case, such that privilege didn't apply.
Right, okay, and so I'm confused. It seems like your brief and the cases you cite really focus in what we're calling either the litigation privilege or the judicial proceeding privilege.
Sure.
Attorney immunity is a separate concept, and I see your brief really focusing on the judicial proceeding part.
I hope that we covered immunity at least somewhat, but yes, there's a lot of discussion about what I've generally referred to as litigation privilege.
And in terms of the litigation privilege, we don't have a lot of Minnesota case law on it. Mahoney, however, suggests that it could be broad. Chafulius, of course, a non-precedential opinion, says it's narrow. But at this point, do we have any binding case law in Minnesota that applies it beyond the defamation context?
Well, the Mahoney-Hagberg case involved more than pure defamation claims.
But didn't the Supreme Court say that in that case that the other claims really sounded in defamation? And do we have that situation here or not?
Well, the record is so convoluted in this case, Your Honor. But let me try to parse out the way I try to parse out the claims in my own mind, because for the first couple of years, all we were litigating about was what was happened in 2021, which they ended up claiming that is defamation. What was said in the complaint, what was alleged in the complaint, handed to the Star Tribune, defamation. That's all. That's the only claim that applies to the events of 2021.
Right.
For the events of 2023, that single memorandum of law opposition memo filed in response to a motion in limine, they assert not just defamation on that one, but also invasion of privacy. So that 2023 cases or brief is the only conduct for which they tie something other than defamation. And I would
again. My question is: what do we have any case law that would say that litigation privilege applies to the invasion of privacy?
Yes, I think it's very clear that litigation. I mean, it's not just the Mahoney-Hagberg case in Minnesota. There's about 400 years of precedent on litigation privilege in the English legal system. The restatement Minnesota basically follows the restatement of torts on this claim, and I think it's very clear. There are some cases that go either way on the whole press, you know, talking about the press. But I don't think there's any disagreement that if that memorandum of law is privileged that was filed making arguments in opposition to a motion, that any common law claim must fail as a matter of law, whether it's defamation or invasion of privacy. I don't think there's been any contention otherwise by the respondent, Mr. Cook.
And you're talking about the 2023 claim that involves the actual judicial proceeding itself with respect to the documents, whether they're confidential or not.
Well, right. I mean, single memorandum of law. There's a bunch of discussion in the briefs about, well, should this have been filed under seal? And that's really a separate issue from whether privilege applies. I think that this court recognized that in the December 2nd decision issued in that Trimble case.
Well, that discussion, that opinion talked about attorney-client privilege. So it's somewhat related, but...
No, I'm talking about the one just a couple months ago. This is at least my third trip to the Court of Appeals in this case.
But we know this has actually been the fifth case before us. But.
In 2023, we were here arguing about attorney-client privilege, and this court issued a writ of prohibition to stop enforcement of the Hennepin County District Court that was going to require these folks to sit and answer questions in a deposition about everything they talked about with their client.
Right, that's my point. That was
attorney-client privilege.
Okay.
But the decision that this court issued just 2 months ago reversed the Dakota County decision, not on attorney-client privilege, but on the notion that the special master had declared, I don't think litigation privilege should apply to this memorandum of law. Feel free to go sue these guys for defamation in some other court.
I want to go back to the 2021, the pre-litigation statement that was made. And you argue that you cite to Mahoney about absolute privilege extends to statements published prior to the judicial proceeding, but in order for the privilege to apply, such statements must have some relation to the judicial proceedings.
Right.
That's part of it, but the Supreme Court did go on to say that, provide some examples, for instance, in conferences and other communications preliminary to the proceedings, in a deposition or affidavit published prior to judicial proceedings. Those all sound in judicial proceedings. Those seem very different than a press statement. So why should a press statement be protected by the judicial proceedings?
Well, first of all, we've cited a case where the statement alleged to be defamatory before the judicial proceedings started was actually a letter sent out to various individuals. So I don't think it's limited to judicial proceedings. But here again, we have a kind of a bit of an unusual circumstance in which the case is underway in terms of settlement negotiations, right? There were months of settlement negotiations, communications between counsel. The gist of the defense that was being asserted at that time by Mr. Cook's legal team was Ms. Trimble has done other bad things and we're going to, you know, show that. So hours before this case is filed, the complaint is shared with the Star Tribune along with contact information for the person who is then Mr. Cook's attorney, David Valentini. The whole point was, let's try to guard against a situation where the first thing out of the box that the press hears about is a one-sided, unfair character assassination of Gracelyn Trimble.
Which may be the defense to the claim, but how does it impact our decision whether the pre-litigation statements to the press, and when I know pre-litigation is like, well, pre-filing by matter of hours, but how do we reconcile that with the lack of case law in Minnesota that says anything you do before that statements to the press before you actually commence a lawsuit fall within the judicial privilege?
The test is, does it relate to the case? That's what Mahoney and Hagberg says. Does it relate to the case? I think that's what the restatement of torts
says.
There's
no case at that point.
Well, there's a complaint. Well, they've mediated the case. There's a claim. There's a dispute. They've mediated it with a third-party mediator. They've met, counsel have met to talk about the case. The conversations in those settlement meetings are the things that they're holding up to show that actual malice exists. It was an attempt to have a fair and balanced report out as the initial report. That attempt failed, right? We pointed out the brief, but the first report, public report on this case was an absolutely one-sided ESPN report. The Hennepin County Court gets that timeline wrong in every single order that these dispositive motions that I made. But that the test is, does it relate? And I think it does. I'm out of time, so I will sit down and maybe have a few more points for reply.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, you will have 15 minutes, and please feel free to adjust the podium and microphone. There is a time clock, as noted, on it, so be mindful of your time as well, and you may begin to proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. Janelle Dresden on behalf of the respondent, Delvin Cook, and I would like to focus my arguments today on the litigation privilege. I think that's what the focus really was in the briefing and of this appeal. And specifically, we can call it the litigation privilege or the judicial proceedings privilege, and I think we mean the same thing. An attorney's duty to zealously represent his or her client must be balanced against the attorney's duty to the public as an officer of the court to further the administration of justice. And that's what this court needs to review on a de novo basis in determining whether the litigation privilege should apply both to the 2021 conduct at issue and the 2023 conduct.
With respect to the 2023 filing of something in an existing court proceeding, that just seems like the quintessential situation when the litigation privilege would apply. So I'm having a hard time understanding why that is not so here.
We have to look, I think, at the context of the filing in this circumstance, and also I want to address broadly first the application of the privilege and the policies behind it, because it is not absolute. I agree with Judge Reyes that it is a misnomer, and we know that because the case law says that. In fact, the Mathis case, which is Minnesota Supreme Court from 1954 adopting this, says that it's supposed to be applied narrowly. Then we have case law, including from the Minnesota Supreme Court, that says there are exceptions to this. And in determining what the exceptions are, The court must absolutely consider whether applying the privilege is necessary to the administration of justice, whether the administration of justice requires complete immunity, and must evaluate competing policy interests. And an exception should apply when we have evidence of a violation of a court order, we have a violation of court rules, and we have violation of longstanding policies in Minnesota. And when
are those factors that really apply to a privilege? Those sound like those are factors that would be considered as to whether or not the district court wants to issue sanctions, whether there's a potential Rule 11 violation. That seems to be a different issue than whether or not a privilege applies.
I don't think it's different at all, because in assessing whether the privilege applies, the Minnesota Supreme Court has directed that there needs to be a determination of and counterbalancing of policies. Well, what are the other policies that come into play in this case? The other policies that come into place in this case is that we expect lawyers, even when they're zealously advocating for their clients, to follow court orders, follow court rules, and follow the policies that govern those lawyers. When you counterbalance that against whether you should apply the privilege, the conclusion here is it should not apply in the context when we have evidence that those things were violated, and intentionally so violated. And that's what the evidence shows. We have three judges in this case, district court judges, who have looked at this conduct and said it was in bad faith, it was intentional, and it wasn't for a proper purpose. We have two judges, both Judge Blazer appointed as special master, and Judge Cork saying, you violated Rule 11. You violated...
Which would set up sanctions, getting to Judge Reyes's question. I mean, I'm troubled. The claims here are not about sanction and breaking the rules. Really, the claim is defamation. That the state, well, and invasion of privacy. So don't we have to look at the application of the privilege through the lens of what are the claims? Because as I understand the privilege, it is designed particularly to protect from defamation claims, in particular, the content of statements made in a court proceeding.
And what we I don't disagree with that, Your Honor. However, you have to look at this in the context of the manner in which this was filed, and in the context of also our publication of private facts claim. Okay, part of this claim and part of what was unlawful and improper here was the filing of these confidential settlement communications publicly, and the purpose for doing that at 11:08 p.m. when those communications were clearly marked confidential, and there was a protective order in the case, and we know under Rule 408 that those are supposed to be protected as confidential. And we have, in addition, admissions by the appellants stating the reason they filed those publicly and the reason they were asking to have them in evidence for the court and taint the jury pool is because they wanted to prove, quote, Mr. Cook's guilt. Okay, that suggests that they wanted to intentionally violate Rule 408, which expressly says...
That's why they're sanctioned, right? I mean, again, we get back to the, okay, what is the privilege designed to be an alternative to sanctions or a different sanction, or withholding the privilege as another form of sanction? That's what I'm concerned about, that we're mixing the apples and oranges here.
The sanctions are not sufficient in this case, Your Honor. The sanctions do not compensate Mr. Cook for the damage that was caused to him. $20,000 reimbursement of attorney's fees doesn't even get close to the significant damage that was caused here. And that's what the court has to analyze. How does he recover for his damage for a lawyer taking into his own hands and deciding to publicly file a document that no doubt should have been filed confidentially?
What's the most apposite case that supports your argument that the alleged defamatory statements were made in the proceeding should influence whether the privilege applies or not?
There are multiple cases in which courts have found that the privilege does not apply to litigation misconduct.
And are you relying on foreign cases?
I am, however, yes, and we've cited them, and the Mason case is one of them, the Landry's case is one of them. I think it might be a Shea is another one, but what I want to point out, or no, it's Matsura, which is out of Hawaii, and it's 2003 Supreme Court. What I want to highlight about that, though, is the Mahoney case, which is the Minnesota Supreme Court from 2007, cited that Matsura case. And the court said, quote, before applying absolute privilege, we look to see if there are competing policy interests that would counsel against application of the privilege. See Matsura, and then in the parens it says, noting that the general public interest in encouraging zealous advocacy as part of the search for truth is counterbalanced by the need to adequately punish and discourage litigation misconduct. And the Matsura case says when there's litigation misconduct, it's appropriate for there to be both sanctions and for their claim to stand. And particularly because how else do you compensate the victim, in this case Mr. Cook, for the damage that is caused to him by a violation of these rules? Sanctions are intended to deter, not to compensate. We have to provide for both.
And isn't that what damages are for on the underlying merits of the case, though?
That's why we need to be able to proceed with the underlying case. The underlying case Mr. Cook has brought against the appellants to seek damages for the damage that was caused to him by this conduct. Which
counsel, on the subject of merits, what is the evidence of actual malice? It seems like there's evidence in the record that the appellants believed the version that they were being provided by Ms. Trimble, their client. So what can you really focus in on actual malice and that sort of merits question?
And are you referring to the 2021 conduct?
Yes.
Okay. Absolutely. So first of all, in our brief, we have detailed it extensively and cited to the record on pages 12 through 14 of all of the evidence that was available to the appellants at the time that they decided to file this complaint and before they brought it to the press. And I just want to one aside to add to that. The arguments that you heard from appellant's counsel this morning suggested that the only thing that was communicated to the press was this unserved and unfiled complaint. That's not true. There was also an interview done, statements made by appellant's counsel with reporter Rochelle Olson, and there was a press release that contained defamatory statements that was made. But back to your question, Judge Bond, the details include things such as they had medical records from Ms. Trimble going to the hospital 5 days later that are completely inconsistent with the story that they told to the press. Completely inconsistent. They do not support any of the claims that she made. They had pictures of her within days going out and getting a full leg tattoo. Yet she claimed that all of these things happened and she was in such horrible condition. They had met with Mr. Cook's attorneys, Mr. Manka and Mr. Valentini, where they had shared information, and again, we detail it in the briefing. All of these things were sufficient enough for them to be reasonably suspicious and question.
But is that the standard? I mean, we also have the photos of the injuries, especially in the facial area. We have the statements of your client after the fact saying, I'm sorry, and I'll take my consequences with the police if you report this. I mean, it seems to me that you're asking us to establish a rule that would have some pretty significant consequences in terms of when are lawyers entitled to believe their client.
I think when we have this extensive evidence, the result is this is why the jury gets to decide the issue.
Right, but that should be, but is that really what we're looking at this stage? Aren't we looking at what the attorneys for Trimble knew and the information that they were provided, as Judge Berkman said, the photographs, the statement by Mr. Cook, the affidavits and the statements and testimony or statements by Ms. Trimble. Now, this kind of sounds like a he said, she said, classic, this is what happened. But aren't we looking at it from the lens of what the attorneys, whether or not they had sufficient evidence to go forward with their claims? I mean, that has nothing to do with whether or not they're going to succeed or not. But that's, you go by what information you're provided from your client.
And you have, in this case, the evidence, well, there's evidence extensively, though, that shows that the statements that they were making to the press, and this, we have to go back, this is, we're not saying that what you put in the complaint and you filed and served because you put it in the complaint and filed and served it, it's defamation. You went to the press and reported these things before there was ever a judicial proceeding. And in the face of having direct evidence from your own client.
Why can't you go forward with information to the press that is consistent with what you have in your complaint?
Because there's no protection for that. It has no relation to the judicial proceeding at all.
Well, there are two issues here. That one, you're talking about the judicial proceeding privilege, but there's also the separate issue of whether or not there's any actual malice on behalf of the lawyers going forward with the evidence.
Yes, and on the actual malice, let me tell you another piece of evidence they had. They had the text messages from their own client that said she went into Mr. Cook's home that night, and we all know it was uninvited, and maced him, and then everything went left, and pulled his hair. They had extensive evidence in front of them.
And we also have the evidence that she had in her affidavit talking about how he had assaulted her, about how all the physical harm that he had inflicted on her. Again, it seems like a classic he said, she said. So I share Judge Bjorkman's concerns. It seems like this would stymie any lawyer from being able to go forward in a case when you do have conflicting evidence and conflicting stories, but why shouldn't they be able to move forward with their case?
It's not about moving forward with the case. It's not about that. It's about the fact that they repeated these allegations to the press with no protection. They repeated this and went out and told their story and made this a media campaign.
I want to go back to this absolute privilege issue because appellants are arguing for what sounds like a fairly broad rule. But the case law, we don't have any clear guidance in Minnesota, but case law is split on that in terms of whether or not that should apply. What about the statements that Mr. Cook had made to the press? Are those, if those were reversed and you were seeking protection for Mr. Cook's lawyer's statements, do you think it should be applied directly? Do you think it should be applied generally, but there are exceptions to the rule? Because some case law seems to indicate that there should be, that in general it should apply to pre-litigation statements, but there are certain requirements in order to be able to meet those standards. For example, it has to have obviously some relation to the proceeding. The restatement talks about it has to be contemplated in good faith and under serious consideration. I'm trying to figure out where this line is as to, is it just absolute, it should not apply at all to pre-litigation statements, or can apply in certain limited circumstances?
I think that the decision in the Schifolius case is what the law should be. And I realize it's an unpublished decision of this court. But in the Schifolius decision, the court said that statements made to the media are not privileged, whether that's Mr. Cook's lawyers, whether any lawyer, that is the risk that you take when you take your case to the media and you start talking about it in the media. And the Schifolius case, and I see I'm out of time, if I can finish this thought, the Schifolius case does cite to Eighth Circuit law on this point and to the restatement of torts of it not applying to the media. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Just a few points, Your Honor. The Schifolius case, that involved, I think that was the opinion of former Judge Raleigh Amundson in this court, 25 years ago or plus. That involved a lawyer by the name of Laurie Peterson, who did an extensive interview on TV on ABC News, I believe, talking about how horrible this person was who she was suing, not presented as part of, this is what my client's allegations are, something like that. And the court said that didn't apply privilege with the idea that this didn't really have anything to do with the case. This was an attorney, Lori Peterson, just going off on her own interview. That is not what we have.
Well, I don't. Maybe I'm looking at a different opinion. I'm looking at an opinion from December 30th, 2003. I mean, and what strikes me is that what our court said, albeit in a non. It's a non-precedential opinion. Okay. But what we said in that case was that, yes, the statements that she made to the media, which actually were made after the litigation was commenced, right. So that's a different fact. But even though they may relate to, they are not integral to the judicial process. And so that was our reasoning. That seems to make some sense. Why should we adopt a different rationale here?
I would say this is a different... Mr. Craig and the lawyers here that I'm representing were deposed and explained exactly what the purpose was. And the purpose was, as we've described in the briefs, to try to avoid what actually ended up happening, which is Mr. Cook got out there, did a character assassination, untrue story on ESPN about their client, Gracelyn Trimble, resulted in just a flood of public sympathy for Mr. Cook.
So you're saying this really isn't a case where we should rest on litigation misconduct to apply an exception to the litigation privilege?
This was integral to the representation of the client.
It seems to me that what you're arguing is the trial in the court of public opinion, and the trial in the court of public opinion is different than the trial before the court of law. I mean,
no. Well, they're worried about the jury that's ultimately going to be impaneled in this case in a court of law.
Well, but that gets addressed by voir dire in terms of whether or not people have been exposed to any media or any communication. And so, I mean, that seems to be something that the court proceedings will already address.
That they will address that as well. But there are cases that we cite, not a Minnesota case, but there are several cases outside Minnesota that say it's okay to apply common sense in this situation. When you're talking about, she says it's more than the complaint, it wasn't really more than the complaint.
What is the rule of law that you're asking this court to adopt then as far as the litigation privilege and its applicability to statements to the media? Is it factually limited? Is it what? Articulate what the rule is that you're asking for.
The rule is that if the privilege protects statements made in attorney-prepared pleadings. We have an attorney-prepared complaint that was handed to the Star Tribune. It really need not matter if it was handed to the Star Tribune an hour before it was publicly filed or an hour after it was publicly filed. There are cases that say, let's use common sense. Complaints are available in this day and age.
When you say attorney prepared pleadings, are you talking about, for instance, attorney prepared pleadings that are part of the judicial proceeding?
That are pleadings that are being used in the judicial proceeding. I don't think it matters that we should not have a rule of law that it says, well, if it was handed to media an hour before it was filed, you're at great risk. But if it's handed an hour after it's filed, you're fine. It's going to be, this case was going to be reported on in the media. The media was going to pick up on a Delvin Cook case. I and most other trial lawyers read all the case filings that happen every day in Minnesota. This was going to be made known.
Can I ask just a question going to the issue of actual malice? So setting aside the question of whether the privilege applies or not, let's assume for the sake of this question that does not apply. How do you respond to the argument that there was evidence here of that your client's statements to the media were made with actual malice, or at least there's a question of fact that goes to the jury on actual malice? How do you respond to that?
A couple things. First of all, actual malice is a question of law for the court. It needs to have a clear and convincing standard, and it needs to show that the lawyer knows darn well that what they're saying is false or something close to that, reckless, right? So what my suggestion is for the point of law, if in a case like this, the lawyer has ample evidence to survive a Rule 11 standard, ample evidence to survive a summary judgment motion, how can it be that you could establish that they knew darn well it was false? If they can show a fact issue, because in a settlement communication, some lawyer said, we think your client acted goofy in other ways. They didn't even come up with a different story about what happened the night in question. They're just going after Trimble's character. That's enough to be able to say, well, you better not tell anybody you're pursuing this case. Otherwise, you're going to get sued for defamation, dragged through discovery, move to disqualify you, all of that. That would be a very, very dangerous rule of law in Minnesota and potentially have disastrous impacts across the state. That's exactly the reason we have a Uniform Public Expression Protection Act now on the books to try to stop these cases before all these parades of horribles comes out. So that's my basic, I'm sorry, I've gone on too long again. That's my basic response.
Thank you, counsel. Looks like there are no further questions. Thank you to both counsel for your briefing and your oral arguments. We appreciate it. We will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory time frame.
Thank you.
Thank you all.